Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Kate Horner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Horner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will be able to ask questions on today's seminar. A handout is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, click on the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Next, click on the link that says Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, on the link that says Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Once again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click on the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on the link that says Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, on the link that says Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Jillian Lampert. Dr. Lampert is the Director of Communications, Outreach, and Research at the EMILY Program. Today, she'll be sharing information with us on myths and truths of eating disorders. Thank you, Dr. Lampert.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everybody. Welcome. I'm going to be walking through the handout, and I will try to let you know when I'm switching slides so that you can follow along. So I'll be talking today about myths and truths about eating disorders, which is one of the things that I really enjoy talking about. I've been working in the field of eating disorders for about 18 years, and I'm always amazed at how much has changed over the last 18 years and how much some of the core myths still are out there. So I'm pleased today to be talking about some of these myths and give you some more information. So I hope that you find this useful. And I'm going to go to the first slide and talk about, there's a cute little cartoon, if you have it in your handout. And it's these two young girls or adult women, I'm not sure which, but I'm going to assume it's somewhere in there. And one of the females is saying to the other, I just know if I could only lose a few pounds, everything in my life would fall into place. And I think the one of the problems with eating disorders is this over-concern about weight and shape. The important part about this cartoon is that over-concern about weight and shape is set in a cultural context where so many people in our culture, in our society, are worried about weight and shape and have this belief that if we could just get our weight to the right place, that everything else would be perfect. And that becomes one of the biggest myths in the eating disorder, that people end up with struggling with eating disorders end up believing or feeling like if they could just get their way to a certain place, whatever the eating disorder diagnosis is, if they could just get their way to a certain place, that everything would be fine. And the reality is, whether you have an eating disorder or not, getting your way to a certain place does not magically fix anything. And that anything that is troubling to you emotionally or in your stressful in your life doesn't magically disappear just because your weight changes. So I start my presentation with this cartoon to put us in the context of our societal concern about weight and shape that's so overwhelming and I think really contributes in part to the development of eating disorders and also makes recovery from eating disorders challenging in that recovery involves letting go of this belief, letting go of this myth. That really, it's not about weight and shape. It's really about a lot of other things in life that help our life to sort of fall into place. And when it doesn't fall into place, we need to have good coping strategies to figure out what to do next. So moving to the next slide, the one that says, what if we change the way we thought? There's a YouTube link, and we're actually not going to watch this today, but I have it on there for your future reference, and I will talk about it for a minute just to give you a context for it. But it's a fantastic little video that you can look at that gives a lot of information, and it's done by a group called Tri Delta, which is a sorority that worked with a researcher from Texas to put together a body image, healthy body image program. And this video, it's part of what they call Fat Talk Free Week, And it's Fat Talk Free Week encourages people to not talk badly about their bodies and to not fall into the trap of thinking that it's all about how I look or if I could just lose weight that everything would be okay. So I encourage you to take some time today or another day to check out that video and to see what you think and to see if anything is surprising in there. It's really, I think, it's a fun video. It's well done. And the fascinating part to me, you'll notice when you watch it, is that it is done entirely with words and no images. And part of what we know in eating disorders is that the images that all of us see every day that we're bombarded with fuel this sort of weight desire or belief that if I could just get my weight to a certain place, that everything would be okay. So I encourage you to take a look at that as one other resource. And moving to the next slide, we're going to talk about some really eating disorder basics. And these are basics that you may be aware of, but they're also really good information, pieces of information to share with the people in your life that are curious about eating disorders or don't understand eating disorders or aren't really convinced that they're not that big of a problem or whatever their concern is. Because a lot of people have a lot of myths and a lot of misinformation about eating disorders. So the first one is that eating disorders are common. We know that over 14 million people in the United States have an eating disorder. 14 million is a really big number. How does that really break down? It's 1 in 16 females and 1 in 33 males. So it's about 6% of females and 3% of males. It's really a significant number of people. And other studies show us that half of Americans know somebody with an eating disorder. So it really is something that impacts an enormous number of people that we really need to pay more attention to. So the second, eating disorders don't discriminate, speaks to that in those 14.5 million people, it's not just women. Eating disorders affect men, they affect women, they affect boys and girls, all ages, all races, all ethnicities, socioeconomic classes, what have you. But eating disorders historically have been, again, a myth, thought of as illnesses that affect primarily adolescent girls in a higher socioeconomic status. And we know that that's a myth, that eating disorders do not discriminate. They affect people across all walks of life. Excuse me. The last point on this slide, eating disorders aren't caused by just one thing. And I hear, as a clinician, I often will hear people say, so if we could just figure out what happened and what caused this eating disorder, then we could figure out what to do about it. And the reality is that it's never just one thing. That eating disorders are complex and that they require comprehensive treatment, that it's the search for the one reason that's causing eating disorders will be a fruitless search, and that we know that eating disorders require a whole comprehensive treatment, which we'll talk about in a minute. So moving to the next slide, this one is one of my favorite myths, is that favorite in that it's one of the ones that I like to dispel the most, because people often believe that you can tell someone has an eating disorder by looking at them. And the truth is you can't often tell by looking at someone that they have an eating disorder. And most people with eating disorders don't, quote-unquote, look like they have an eating disorder. And this gets at this stereotype that it's only adolescent young women who are underweight that we think of as having eating disorders. When in reality, people with eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes, and that the number of people that have really low weight as part of their eating disorder symptom is actually the minority of people with eating disorders. That most people, you can't tell that they're struggling with their weight. You can't tell that they're struggling with thoughts about weight and shape and eating. So that it's not something you can just look at someone and see that they have an eating disorder. And the last one I think is the most important piece, is that people get better. That people always ask me, oh, you work in eating disorders, that's, you know, people, they just have to struggle their whole lives, right? And I don't believe that that's true. People get better, people can have full recovery, and people don't have to struggle with an eating disorder for their whole life. That said, recovery takes time, it takes courage, it takes practice, it takes a significant amount of time. It didn't happen overnight, it won't go away overnight. So recovery does take a significant amount of time, but it can happen. And then we have a couple more that have come up a little bit sort of more recently, that eating disorders are just a teenage phase, that this is just, you know, teenagers will grow out of it. Teenagers are just supposed to worry about their bodies. They'll just be fine if we give them a little time and they'll grow out of it. That, like I said before, not only teenagers get eating disorders, they're not a phase, and that they do need treatment. And I've had I've had people in my office say, well, you know, I'm not eating that differently than the other people at lunch with me in my class. And I say, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have an eating disorder. It might mean that more people need to get treatment in your school than just you, but right now let's focus on you. So it's not just a passing phase, and it's not something that if we just wait it out, it will go away. If we wait it out, it will get worse. Eating disorders, this is the other myth, that eating disorders are a lifestyle choice, that they're not really a serious illness. And this has been promoted a little bit by the pro-anorexia website movement, that there are websites that are that seem very supportive of eating disorders and supportive of people having an eating disorder, practicing eating disorder behaviors, and have gotten a fair amount of media attention and have sort of introduced this idea that maybe eating disorders are just a choice and not really an illness. And that, we know, is completely false, that eating disorders are a brain-based biological illness. They have the highest mortality rate of all psychiatric illnesses. They have numerous physical medical complications. This is not something that people decide to venture into. This is not something that somebody wakes up one morning and says, I think I'll get an eating disorder to lose some weight. That's just not true. That eating disorders happen for a whole complex set of reasons, and they are a serious illness. And we see some of the stigma around eating disorders getting better, but there still is some significant stigma left that's communicated when people say, well, why don't you just eat? Why don't you just stop throwing up? That's not how recovery happens. People just don't stop doing something or start doing something. They need help. They need tools. They need skills. They need to practice in order to get those things back to normal. So moving along, eating disorders just affect women. That's another myth. And it's eating disorders have never just been a female illness. Part of the issue is that because the attention that eating disorders has gotten in the media has been mostly around females, which has left society thinking that they're just illnesses that impact women, and this just simply isn't true, that males get eating disorders too, and the increased awareness we've had in the last 10 years has really helped males know that if they are struggling with eating disorder behaviors, that they can get help too, that this isn't just a female illness, that it happens in males. And in fact, we know that probably about a third of the people with eating disorders are males when we look at the whole eating disorder spectrum. So it's not just women. And then the other myth on this page, eating disorders care is accessed by everyone who needs treatment, that if you have an eating disorder, you can get treatment. And this simply, unfortunately, is not true. Only about 10 to 20% of people get treatment, and it's such a low number for a number of reasons. So there are barriers related to insurance coverage. There's barriers related to stigma, lack of resources. If you don't live close to a center that has specialized eating disorder treatment, well, then it's hard to get specialized eating disorder treatment. So eating disorders care is one of those areas of medical care that we really are working to expand and increase access for everybody who needs it, and really work with all the various players to make sure that people can get treatment, because we know that if people get treatment, they can get better. We also know that people don't get treatment, they tend not to get better very quickly, if at all. And so that can be a real barrier to getting one's life back and to living a fulfilling, recovery-focused life. So we really need to continue to educate the public and ourselves about this issue of treatment access. So then we move into some eating disorder questions on the next slide. And these are some of the questions that I get. I often tell the story that when I travel on a plane, I don't talk to the people sitting next to me all that often. Because when I say that I work in eating disorders, people tend to kind of ask or make one of three comments. They say, well, you know, I know somebody who has an eating disorder, and that's great, and that's fine, and we have a lovely conversation about their experience with it. It's the other two comments that really illustrate to me how much more education we need to do and how much more attention we need to give eating disorders as a society. Because people will say, the two things they say is, well, why don't they just stop that? Or why would they do that is one of the questions. And the other question or the other comment is really disturbing as well. It's, oh, you know, I wish I could have an eating disorder just for like a month so that I could lose some weight. So I think those two comments, which are quite disturbing, beg these questions of, you know, why do people think that? Why do people ask questions like, why don't they just stop doing that? Or why would they do that? And how could I do it so that I could lose weight? It illustrates, I think, an not enough understanding of what eating disorders are, and also demonstrates the second comment, really underscores that societal desire to lose weight that really fuels a lot of this weight concern. So I want to try to address some of those questions so that I can tell you a little bit about what I tell people on the plane, and then you can tell people that ask you similar questions in your life when you talk about knowing somebody with an eating disorder. So this whole, why don't they just eat or stop throwing up or stop binging, it's not that simple. That eating disorders are complex. Like I said before, recovery is complex. They don't develop overnight. They don't resolve quickly. But that people need to practice and need to learn different ways to cope emotionally. They need to learn different ways to relate to food and to their bodies, and that it's not just something they can stop doing just like that. We also know that there are some really interesting findings in research about brain circuitry and all of the brain wiring we have that looks at how we regulate our appetite and how we regulate our food intake and how we get reward out of food. So it's a very complex picture in our brain. Behavior is a complex picture, and changing behaviors is a complex picture. So it's just not that simple is the answer to that question. There's a lot longer answer to it, but I think that helping people to understand that it's just not a simple thing to stop is really important. And then the second one on this slide, why do they affect more females than males? So I told you that increasingly eating disorders, we're seeing males accessing treatment, and that we know that males get eating disorders, but they do affect more females than males. And why is that? And we do believe that the pressure for females to meet appearance standards really has been traditionally stronger for females than for males. If you look in the greater culture, be it in magazine ads or in movies or on TV or on the internet or even at your local mall, when you look at the pictures in the window or you look at the mannequins, that there's an extraordinarily strong pressure for females to meet a very thin ideal. And that it's sort of a standard female ideal that shows up repeatedly in photos and in mannequins. And we disembody the female body in ads where we'll just show, you know, part of a woman's body, or we show the woman's body as much more of an object than actually a person, that we objectify women's bodies in incredibly strong ways in our culture. And we're starting to do that with men as well, that you'll see increasingly in advertisements and media showing a male ideal that is sort of common across different advertisers, different product lines, different companies, different stores, what have you, that the media is really, unfortunately, leveling the playing field with this pressure, that men are feeling increasing pressure to look a certain way. So that I like to think if you were, you know, an alien that landed on Earth and looked around, you would quickly learn from what you saw that the ideal for females is a thin, young-appearing woman, and that the ideal for men is a muscular, confident-appearing male, and that you would see that those themes repeated in all of our advertising and much of our messaging. So it doesn't take too much observing to see that message sort of play out everywhere you look. Moving to the next slide. When my computer left me, there we go. How are eating disorders connected to obesity? And that's a question that we're looking at a little bit more with research the last 5 to 10 years, that one of the eating disorders, and I'll run through the different eating disorder categories in a minute, but that one of the eating disorders, namely binge eating disorder, often leads to excessive weight gain and may contribute to weight issues for really a significant proportion of the population of particularly American adults. And that there is some connection or sort of eating disorders, obesity could be thought of as on a spectrum. At this point, obesity is not considered a psychiatric illness. Eating disorders are, so there's certainly some strong differences between them. But we do know that there is this connection between binge eating disorder and excessive weight gain that's worth continued looking at. So we think of it as a spectrum, and really, again, people with eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes. So we know that there is a spectrum of weight that we're looking at when we're talking about eating disorders. And then we sort of covered the next one already. So do eating disorders happen for a specific reason? And I've already told you that they're complex and that they happen for multiple reasons. And the next slide, the one with the bubbles on it, the orange bubbles, let's say psychology, biology, and social environment, is just a picture that I use to try to illustrate factors are involved in the development of an eating disorder. But it's not just the media. It's not just the cultural pressures to fit in and this media flood of thin females and muscular males. It's not just that strong message to change the way you look in order to be accepted or to be successful. Certainly all of those social environmental factors can be a part of eating disorders, but there's also this biology piece and the psychology piece. So I want to do the biology piece first briefly, that when we look at biology, that's the sort of physical body pieces that we think about. That's our neurotransmitters, the chemicals in our brain. That's the process of puberty or the process of menopause. It's the physical changes that happen when we restrict our food intake or diet. And it's also our genetics that predispose us to certain things. So in the biology piece, it starts with food restriction. So that if we took this whole group of all of us listening on the phone and all of us restricted our food intake, that would impact our biology and our bodies would say, something's not right. There is food restriction. Genetically, evolutionarily, sort of our bodies are designed to respond strongly to semi-starvation or food restriction. So that our bodies have these internal mechanisms that say, oh no, I don't have enough food. I need to motivate to get food. So people start to think about food more. They start to seek out food. And that happens when you diet. And that the dieting in people with eating disorders can sort of take on a life of its own. And people will often talk about their eating disorder starting with a diet, like started on a diet or I cut out a set of food groups or one food group. And before I knew it, it had spiraled into this very restrictive way of eating. And part of why that happens, we don't fully understand. And part of why it happens, we do understand in this narrowed focus on food, in the case of eating disorders, instead of promoting getting more food, it actually promotes restricting food or making lots of rules around food. But some of those rules that people with eating disorders often have about food come from this sort of biological rewiring that happens in our brain when we have food restriction. And the genetics piece helps to address the question that how come not everybody who goes on a diet ends up with an eating disorder? And that's a valid question because it's true that not everybody who goes on a diet ends up with an eating disorder. Some people do. Many people don't. And for the some people who do, there's probably some genetic predisposition. And that's not to say that there's an eating disorder gene or that we'll find the one gene that codes for an eating disorder. It's to say that there are probably some other genetic factors at play that connect to the psychology bubble, but also connect to a very complex brain system. So we're really beginning to understand that there, for example, seems to be a genetic predisposition for some people to have really strong dopamine responses. So that if you, dopamine is the sort of connected to the pleasure center in our brain. So when we see pleasurable things, we see beautiful art, for example, or we eat a delicious food, or we have a very pleasurable experience, that part of our brain is really the place where we experience that. And it feels good. And we enjoy looking at nice, beautiful art, and we enjoy good food. It's also the part of the brain that responds to stimulant drugs, that would respond to cocaine, that would respond to other things that we wouldn't be seeking out in the same vein as pleasurable art. But it's the same part of the brain. And that we know that for some people whose dopamine is really triggered by food, enjoyment of food, really experiences that enjoyment of food, or has some problems with that system, they might be more genetically predisposed to struggling with an eating disorder if they started to change the way that they eat. So it's this complicated sort of jigsaw puzzle of factors where you have food restriction as one piece of the jigsaw puzzle and, in my example, a dopamine genetic system that really has a strong response to food, and you put those together, and in the face of food restriction and this dopamine effect, people can end up cementing these eating disorder behaviors. It's a really sort of complex set of interactions that there are a number of those kinds of examples, but we know that there's something about genetics that we need to learn more about. There's also something about more psychological kinds of genetic factors that really talk about how we are sort of personality-wise or character traits that people might have One of those, for example, is orderliness, that there is a character trait of liking things in a certain order, and some people have it and some people don't. Some people feel really comfortable when their bed isn't made in the morning. Some people feel really uncomfortable when their bed isn't made in the morning. But they want the order. So that seeking out orderliness in our life is in part, in a very strong part, a character temperament trait that's genetically mediated, that some people are genetically just neater and some people are genetically not as meeting that neatness in their lives. And that when those genetic tendencies combined with food restriction, part of those lead into eating disorder patterns that we're just beginning to understand. So it really is a complicated set of factors, but it's not just genetics, and it's not just biology, and it's not just psychology. So I'm going to move on into that bubble just to finish the physical changes in puberty and menopause. We know that the incredible changes that young girls and young boys go through in puberty release a whole set of hormones that we're just beginning to understand might have something to do with the development of eating disorders. And that we're trying to really untangle what happens with puberty and the experience of a changing body in the context of a social environment. How does that all feel to the developing adolescent? And then with menopause that women go through, how does that change in body, how is that experienced by women, and how is that body image ideal and experience shifted as women's bodies change again later in life? So we're really looking at some increased research in both puberty and menopause to help us better understand. Then in the psychology bubble, to finish up this slide, there are all sorts of different things in the psychology realm. Stressors, for example, we all have stressors in our life. We have transitions, we have changes. It might be a stressor losing a pet. It might be a stressor like having an adolescent having their parents' marriage dissolve. It might be moving away from friends. It might be a difficult course. It might be a breakup of a relationship. It can be any of those life stressors that happen to all of us. But the reaction to the stress is the important part. The coping skills that people have in reaction to the stress is an important part of that. And if somebody has a lot of transition or stress in their life, coupled with maybe a genetic predisposition towards some of these character temperament traits, coupled with some food restriction, in the midst of a social environmental sea of messages about how we should look, out of that can sort of out of this perfect storm can create an eating disorder. An eating disorder can come out of that. So we really look at stressors and coping skills. How are people's self-esteem, how is their self-esteem developed over adolescence and adulthood? How is self-evaluation and all these personality factors that I alluded to with the orderliness or the neatness? There are others, like whether somebody is more harm avoidant and doesn't like to take risks, or whether somebody is more interested in taking risks. All of those things tell us a little bit about ourselves and how those might interact with biology and the social environment. So it's really the purpose of this model is to give you the sense that it's a much more complex thing than just one comment. I've often had individuals come in and say, you know, in my 10th grade health class, my teacher said that fat is really bad for me. So I started dieting, and they started down the road to the eating disorder that way. And when they look back and think of why the eating disorder started, they go back to that one comment that the health teacher made. Certainly that comment probably wasn't helpful and wasn't accurate, because we do need fat in our diets, but that it wasn't just that one comment that somebody heard that led them down the road to the eating disorder. It was within all these other complex interactions that comment was made that out of that came the eating disorder. So when people say to me, you know, I don't know why they would do that on the plane, I often pull up this bubble and image in my mind and say, well, it's pretty complex, and it's these three different areas, and they all intersect, and out of that, for some people, it's the perfect storm, and the eating disorder takes hold. So we'll move on from that bubble to the next figure, which is an illustration from a book that I quite like by a doctoral level researcher, Diane Neumark Steiner, who wrote a book called I'm Like So Fat. It's a book about adolescents and their struggles with body image, hence the more adolescent-sounding title. But this image is just to show that people with eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes, and that we can't forget that we're talking about a body spectrum of sizes and shapes. And that book has some really helpful information in it about eating and weight behaviors and such. So the next slide is really is simply the list of eating disorder diagnoses, and we're going to go into them in a little bit of detail, not too much, but a little bit. But to say right now, these are the eating disorder diagnoses that we have. We have anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, this one with lots of words, eating disorder not otherwise specified, which is abbreviated as EDNOS. I once had a client tell me that she thought it meant eating disorder not of severity, and therefore she didn't think it was that big of a deal and didn't think that she had a severe, you know, had a severe illness. I thought it was an interesting use of the abbreviation because it sounds kind of clinical. That's not what it stands for, though. It is eating disorder not otherwise specified. And we know that EDNOS, bulimia, and anorexia are equally as serious, and that EDNOS is not less serious than the others. Binge eating disorder is currently a diagnosis within EDNOS, but it will become its own disorder, its own diagnosis next year in the next revision of the book that does all these diagnostic categories. So we'll talk a little bit about that separately. So the next slide is a little bit more detailed on each diagnosis. So this one has anorexia and bulimia, and I'll just highlight some of the high points of it. So anorexia is a serious life-threatening egosyntonic disorder. Well, what does that mean? Egosyntonic means that the illness feels in line with one's values to a point. And this is the part about anorexia that is so confusing from the outside. It's the denial part. It's the part that somebody will say, no, I'm fine. I don't have a problem with food. I'm not, I don't have a problem with restricting. Please don't make me change this. It really shows up in that sort of self-starvation or the food restriction and the fear of weight gain and the distortion of body image where somebody can look at themselves in a mirror and feel like they're enormous, yet when we look at them, they're severely underweight. That in the disorder, it has this very fascinating and dangerous attribute of being really kind of internalized by the person. So the person with anorexia becomes obsessed with food and with weight and counting calories and vigorous exercise, really obsessed with having their value as a person, their value of themselves, based on their weight or their shape or how they can control their food intake. So the way it plays out is people with anorexia often are eating very little. They may be over-exercising. They may be saying, you know, no, I'm fine, despite family members or friends feeling like they're not fine. They may be asking about parts of their body, you know, does this look big? Do I look fat? I can't believe how I look, when really to everybody else they look underweight or they look emaciated. So it really can be a confusing conversation with somebody with anorexia when they think their body is one way, but clearly when you look at them, it's a different way. And then bulimia is slightly different in that it's, again, a serious life-threatening disorder, but it's a little bit more ego-dystonic, we call it. It's a little bit more somebody's able to say, I don't like this behavior. I don't like to have this secret about my eating. I'm binge eating, I'm eating this large amount of food, and then I'm vomiting or I'm doing something to compensate for having eaten that large amount of food, whether it's taking laxatives or over-exercising or skipping meals, taking diuretics or water pills, doing whatever it is to control their weight and feeling really out of control with eating, and again having the same really strong evaluation of who I am, who I am as a person based on what my body looks like. So the difference in the egosyntonic versus the ego-dystonic is that in bulimia, people are generally aware that the behavior they're doing is not quote-unquote normal, that people don't just walk around talking about binge eating and vomiting. On the other hand, people do in our society walk around talking about dieting, and they walk around dieting, and they walk around talking about restricting food, and we give them, in a lot of situations, a fair amount of attention and support for their dieting because we have this strong focus on weight loss. So people with bulimia are often, they feel like they have this huge secret that they can't tell anybody about, that they're very ashamed of, and that they're working really hard to manage in their life, but that they're having a really difficult time talking about. And they generally feel a little bit more like, okay, if somebody could help me not do this and still be able to cope, that would be better. Versus somebody with anorexia who can be very fearful of engaging in treatment and doing things differently with their eating and their weight because it feels like part of them. It feels like it's helping them in some really significant way. If we go to the next slide, it talks a little bit about this EDNOS category and how BED or binge eating disorder fits in, and then this other compulsive overeating diagnosis. So EDNOS right now contains sort of everything else that's not anorexia or not quite bulimia. And you can get a diagnosis of eating disorder not otherwise specified if you don't quite meet the diagnostic criteria for anorexia or you don't quite meet the diagnostic criteria for bulimia. It doesn't mean it's any less serious. It just means that according to the classification scheme, it fits into this category versus one of the other two. Currently, binge eating disorder is in this category, so a subset of people in the EDNOS category will meet a diagnosis for binge eating disorder. And binge eating disorder is similar to bulimia with the overeating part, but there isn't compensatory mechanism use. So there's not purging, people aren't overexercising, they're not making up for, quote unquote, those calories that they consume during the binging. They feel compelled to overeat, they feel out of control, they also have strong weight and shape concerns and that self-evaluation based on how they look and how they're eating and what their body is like. So they feel, again, a large amount of shame because of the way they're eating and because they feel like they can't stop doing it. So they feel really like it's a secret and that they have a hard time talking about it. The compulsive overeating is very similar to binge eating disorder in that it's overeating. It may be more grazing or overeating through the day rather than discrete binges, but it's the same compulsion to overeat. It feels out of control. People speak to this saying things like, I just can't not eat something when I'm working on a project or I'm at my desk. I can't get myself to not eat, and I really feel out of control with food. So whether it's binge eating disorder or compulsive overeating, there's a sense of feeling really out of control with food and feeling quite shameful about that inability to manage food in a more constructive way. So with all of that diagnostic information, you know, why would that happen? And what do eating disorders really, how come they stick around and how come they create such a stronghold in people that struggle with them? That one way to look at it is as sort of an adaptive function, that the eating disorder behavior is doing something. It's doing some job or it's serving some function. For many people, the eating disorder behavior has become a way to function within the world, that if your brain is focused on getting food, remember I told you that as you change your food intake, your brain becomes much more focused on food. So if your brain is very focused on food, where the next meal will come from, what it will be, how you'll feel when you eat it, all of that, that it doesn't leave a whole lot of room to worry about things like how you feel about having to change schools or how you feel about moving or how you feel about your parents' divorce or how you feel about the loss of a friend, that it really focuses people's attention on the food and that takes all of sort of the attention for them to get through the day. So once we can identify that function, that it ends up being this focus and that it sort of protects them from having to think about other things and solve problems that seem really overwhelming, that we can help people to figure out how we can replace that with something else. So that they're more able to function in a way that's much more constructive. So maybe the function, the coping function wasn't developed and that the eating disorder is some way to communicate or to project against that problem or to solve problems. But again, people aren't doing it just because that the eating disorder has come in and sort of hijacked the brain and have these behaviors instilled to keep going to sort of make this adaptation work better. The reality is that it doesn't really work that much better, so we have to help people to figure out different ways that will work better. But when you look at some of those adaptations, you know, keeping your lots of willpower with your food or keeping your body to match the, working to have your body match the societal norms of body appearance, you know, it's hard to argue with those sometimes because people are really doing what society tells them to do, that this eating disorder becomes focused on what the predominant messages are. So we need to help people understand there are other ways to be in a relationship with your body that don't have to have this all-consuming focus on the societal ideal. So what if someone has an eating disorder? What is treatment involved? So I want to tell you a little bit about treatment options, and there are many. So looking at the treatment options slide, treatment really can look a lot of different ways depending on where you live, depending on the illness, depending on what access you have. But there are therapy components to treatment. with a therapist. There are nutrition components to help stabilize the nutritional chaos that people experience. There are lots of medical complications associated with eating disorders that need to be addressed by medical professionals. There are psychiatry, role for psychiatry with different comorbid or co-occurring things that happen along with eating disorders like depression or anxiety, that psychiatry can be really helpful with that. So those are sort of the four main care practitioners that people end up interfacing with, a therapist, a dietitian, a physician, and then a psychiatrist to help with the psychiatry pieces of medicine. And then the last part of the list are really different levels of care. So there's residential, which is a 24-hour-a-day, like an inpatient program, but typically not in a hospital, where people stay for a longer length of time to really resolve the issues that they're working on, to restore weight, to decrease symptom use, whatever their particular treatment plan entails. Intensive day treatment or partial hospital program is a day-long kind of treatment where people spend anywhere from 6 to 12 hours in treatment, practicing eating meals, participating in group therapy, participating in individual work and individual therapy and nutrition, being followed medically. So it's similar to residential, except they sleep at home at night and on the weekends. Intensive outpatient can be a lower level of care that's generally about 3 hours a day, 3 or 4, maybe 5 days a week, where people get a chance to practice the skills that they're learning. They have meals in that group. They have group therapy. They have nutrition therapy. They really have that support to make the changes that they're working on making with their food intake and their emotional coping and their medical status and all of that. There can be family-based therapy. There are many therapies that involve families, many, many programs that involve families. There's a particular family kind of treatment called FBT that really utilizes the family as a strong intervention kind of team. And there can be, you know, outpatient therapy, inpatient therapy group, but it really, treatment can happen in lots of different ways, and it really does depend on what treatment resources are in your area and what those treatment resources look like, and that depending on, hopefully, each of these treatment options that is applied as needed by the person. So you really start with the person and say, what would be the best treatment for this individual person? What do they need? Where is the eating disorder manifesting in the therapy realm, the nutrition realm, the medicine realm? What care do they need, and can we get them that care? And how do we do that? So then the last part is really, where are we going? What are the goals for recovery? Where are we trying to get to? And that we're really trying to get to eating and being active, in tune with the body's needs, being much more connected to our body, both physically and emotionally, helping people to rework those systems of coping, of eating, of moving, so that they become much more integrated with our body's needs rather than separate from our really sort of disconnecting. A simple thing, but more complex when put into practice, eating when you're hungry, stopping when you're full, that relearning those eating signals we have in our body and our brains that really help us know when we want food and when we want to be done eating food. Eating what you really want and eating a variety of foods, not avoiding food out of fear, that many people with eating disorders avoid particular foods out of fear for what it will do, whether it will do something to their body or they will overeat or whatever it is for them, that we really want people to get to the place where they can eat what they want, have a variety of food, have it be flexible and enjoyable and balanced, and not using food or eating disorder behaviors to cope, but using more constructive behaviors to cope and using food to nourish our bodies. So that food or the eating disorder is no longer the focus of the person's day. It becomes more of a distant memory, and they're able to cope in a much more emotionally healthy way and have joyful movement and joyful interactions with other people and be able to have coping skills for difficult situations, for change, for transition, for all those things that are involved in the first place with the eating disorder development. So the last piece is just how to talk to someone you're concerned about. And some of you may have already talked to people you're concerned about or may be considering talking to somebody you're concerned about. And it's really important to ask to talk to them alone in a quiet place and to have your comments be about you and what you've noticed about them. So instead of saying, I think you have an eating disorder, and that may be true, but to reword and really give specific examples, like, I notice you don't want to eat with us anymore. I notice you look sad. You seem preoccupied with your weight or your eating. Whatever it is that you've noticed that's really worrisome to you. I worry because your weight seems low and you want to go running outside in 95-degree weather. That doesn't seem like a good idea to me. I'm concerned about you. What do you think about that? And that's the really important question, is the asking for feedback. What do you think about my concerns? Because the person struggling with eating disorder might say, you know, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. And you can ask them, but I hear that you think you're fine, but what do you think about my concerns? What do you think about these specific things that I've listed? And they may say, well, I think you're wrong or I'm fine again. But it really gives them a little bit different topic to respond to than I think you have an eating disorder. It's really, I noticed you look sad. What do you think about that? Are you feeling sad? Am I not judging that accurately? Hopefully it can generate more of a dialogue than have somebody feel like it's a confrontation. And then ask if you can help. You know, for example, is there something I can do to help? Do you think you need someone else to help? Is there some place you would be willing to go to talk to somebody to see if you need more help? Is there something else that might be helpful at this point for you? Even if they're not willing to have that conversation, then check in again is a very important sort of the last step is really check in again. Even if they say, I'm fine, you can say, you know, I'm really concerned. I want to be supportive. I'd like to check in with you again about this because I'm really worried about you. And generally people take that, you know, that conversation might have to happen a couple times, but people are a little bit more likely to respond to that than when they feel like they're being confronted. So I'll finish with sort of prevention, what can we do about it, that we can all stop dieting. We can all sort of embrace this way of eating that's mindful in terms of eating when we're hungry, stopping when we're full, having strong coping skills. We can encourage identity development and self-esteem and all these wonderful things in young people and adults. But the thing that we can really do that has a strong impact that could impact all of us is really changing the conversation about weight and appearance and changing our use of the media and internalization of the media and changing our belief that we have to have this ideal body weight for males and females that really promotes the dieting culture that we have, and instead focus our energies on promoting health and promoting people to move their bodies in enjoyable ways and to nourish their bodies in ways that really suit their bodies instead of really focusing on what our bodies look like or what we should be eating or what we shouldn't be eating, really working with our bodies much more as a whole. So my last slide is just some quotes that I really like that are really powerful for me that I'll leave you with that I think one of the ones that I point out to many of my clients is that addresses that fear of engaging in treatment, that it feels so scary to come into treatment or to tell somebody you have a problem and to risk change, because that's really scary for us as human beings. So I really like this quote: there came a time when the risk was to remain tight in the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. And that recovery really is blossoming, and that people who go through the treatment process and get to the other side and are able to move along in the recovery process always say it was worth the risk it took. So I will end there and move you into the survey piece, and then we'll move into questions.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you're a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After I finish reading the entire question and all the possible answers, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We will now start with our first question. This session provided me with a better understanding of the eating disorder myths and truths. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, star 4 for strongly disagree. Please stand by while we allow everyone a chance to respond. And for our second question, this session educated me on how to help if I am concerned that someone I know has an eating disorder. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, star 4 for strongly disagree. And once again, we'll pause just a moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. Question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 strongly agree, star 2 agree, star 3 disagree, star 4 strongly disagree. Again, we'll briefly pause. In our fourth question, I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And we'll pause briefly. And our final question. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Or star 4, other. And we'll pause for just a moment. And that concludes today's survey. Thank you for your participation. Now we will begin our question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. At that point, please state your name before posing your question. Once again, that is star 1 to be placed into the queue. And again, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And at this time, we have no further questions, and I'd like to turn the call back over to Kate Warner.
I want to thank everyone so much for attending, and thank Dr. Lampert for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If anyone has specific questions about any of the therapies or types of treatment discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder Team by calling the phone number listed on the back of your insurance card. Please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month on July 24th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon Central and 10 Pacific. Thanks, everyone.
And that concludes today's conference. We appreciate your participation.